Good morning. I woke up a few weeks ago on a Friday morning somewhat depressed. I couldn't figure out why. I didn't go to bed depressed, and I just woke up with the blues. Later that day, I was going to be heading out to Monterey to teach at a retreat for Santa Clara University students to teach it there. Yeah, there we go. For their fellowship, and I wasn't depressed about that. I was looking forward to going to be with the college students to be able to teach them. I felt that I had some helpful things to say to them from the life of Moses. I was, however, a little bit concerned about the times in between when I was going to be teaching. How am I going to relate to them in between those times? Because it's just me and 35, 20-year-olds, and I'm not 20 anymore, and I'm not 30 anymore, and I'm not 40 anymore, and let's just stop right about there. Maybe then, in light of the generation gap, I was feeling my age a little bit. David, toward the end of his life, is definitely feeling his age. He is actually defined as a man who is old and advanced in years. And David's kind of in a funk, it looks like. The narrator doesn't say so, but it looks as if David is depressed. And that's what happens sometimes as people age. They don't have what they used to have. They can't do what they used to do. The friends they used to know, they don't know anymore. And some people, as they age, they get depressed. And David looks as if he's depressed. If we are concerned about a personal decline, or simply we're in a funk, is there anything that can snap us out of it? And we ask the question, is there anything that can snap David out of it? We're going to be looking at 1 Kings chapter 1 today, if you want to make your way there. We're going to work all the way to chapter 2, verse 12. And this is a new book for us. We've been looking at 1 and 2 Samuel, and now we're moving on to 1 Kings to see the end of David's life. And by the way, this is a great Father's Day text. This is David dealing with two sons, especially dealing with the second of those two sons to admonish and encourage him, heading into the next generation. So as fathers, we might want to ask ourselves, as we look at this text, how are we going to encourage the next generation? And when Paul Taylor and I were mapping out the whole series and figuring out who was going to preach who and what was scheduled to do what, we ended up with this, but we really weren't thinking about Father's Day when we scheduled this whole thing. We just stumbled into it. By the way, I was talking to a pastor friend of mine earlier this week, and he has actually chosen this text to preach on Father's Day, and Paul and I just stumbled into it. And so God is really good to us around here. We stumble into so much, it looks like that God is prepared for us. So next week, we're going to be not looking at a text in particular, we're going to be looking at David's life as a whole. As you know, we have walked through the David story for 10 months or so, and we want to figure out what we have learned from all of that. And we also want to set aside a time for you to share, so we're going to have a time of life together as well where we can share our hearts with one another. Okay, 1 Kings chapter 1, verse 1. Now King David was old and advanced in years, and although they covered him with clothes, he could not get warm. Therefore his servants said to him, "Let a young woman be sought for my lord the king, and let her wait on the king and be in his service. Let her lie in your arms, that my lord the king may be warm." So they sought for a beautiful young woman throughout all the territory of Israel, and found Abishag the Shunammite, and brought her to the king. The young woman was very beautiful, and she was of service to the king and attended to him, but the king knew her not. So what are the servants of David up to? They recognize that he has lost his capacity to lead, and they want to revive that. And they think they can revive that by putting this very beautiful young woman in bed with him. They have somehow connected his sex life to his capacity to lead, and so he's in decline. And this is the way ancients thought, by the way, oftentimes about their kings. Their sex life was somehow connected to their capacity to lead. So they hope that they can get David out of bed by putting a beautiful young woman in bed with him. David is old. He's advanced in years. He can hardly get out of bed. He can't keep warm. And so they want this woman to take care of him. But it doesn't work. David didn't know her. No, in the biblical sense. And so he's not with it anymore. He's not really able anymore. And later when you look at the text, on two occasions, this word "no" is connected to what David did not know in terms of what was going on in his kingdom. He did not know that Adonijah had exalted himself as king. So what the servants are trying to do is trying to revive David, but it doesn't work. But it somehow, his incapacity in the bedroom mirrors his incapacity in the throne room. At least that's what his servants think. Now, if you are sensing some sort of personal decline, there are right ways and wrong ways to try to snap yourself out of it. One of those wrong ways, of course, is illicit sex. And many people in our particular culture, as they age, they go looking around for someone younger, and they hope that some kind of involvement with someone younger is going to revive them. Of course, that's the wrong way to go about trying to snap yourself out of a funk. Is there a right way? Verse 5. Now Adonijah, the son of Haggith, exalted himself, saying, "I will be king." And he prepared for himself chariots and horsemen and 50 men to run before him. His father had never at any time displeased him by asking, "Why have you done thus and so?" He was also a very handsome man, and he was born next after Absalom. He conferred with Joab, the son of Zeruiah, and with Abiathar, the priest, and they followed Adonijah and helped him. But Zadok the priest and Benaiah the son of Jehoiada and Nathan the prophet and Shimei and Rei and David's mighty men were not with Adonijah. Adonijah sacrificed sheep, oxen, and fattened cattle by the serpent's stone, which is beside Enrogel, and he invited all his brothers, the king's sons, and all the royal officials of Judah. But he did not invite Nathan the prophet or Benaiah or the mighty men or Solomon his brother. So there's a power vacuum. David is asleep at the switch. It looks like he's in decline. He can't snap out of it. He's in bed. What does Adonijah do? The next son in line, he steps into the power vacuum. But our narrator lets us know that Adonijah is not really qualified to be king. The narrator notes that David has coddled Adonijah just like Absalom. In fact, this particular son is defined in many ways like Absalom was defined. Absalom was coddled. Absalom was the best-looking man in the land. And now we have Adonijah, who is described thus as well. And as Kathy read for us earlier, what does God do when he's looking for a leader? He looks at the heart. That's one of the reasons he discarded Saul. Saul was described as this fair-looking man, the handsomest in the land, and he did not have that kind of heart that the Lord was looking for. Obviously, now, from the narrator's perspective, Adonijah is disqualified. Furthermore, it looks as if by the way that he is, the kinds of people that he is gathering around him, it looks as if he is driving a wedge once again between north and south. David, who was from the south, from the tribe of Judah, worked real hard to try to unify all of Israel, and it looks as if Adonijah is wasting all of that effort by driving a wedge between north and south again. So David's world is changing before him. Our world is changing before us. The world is always changing. The culture is always changing. The church is always changing, in some ways for the better, in some ways for the worse. Now, of course, opinions differ on what constitutes improvement and what constitutes decline. If you are concerned about cultural decline, if you are concerned about ecclesiastical decline, is there anything that you can do? What is it that you can do if you are concerned about such decline? David does nothing. The world is declining and David does nothing, which concerns Nathan the prophet. Verse 11. Then Nathan said to Bathsheba, the mother of Solomon, "Have you not heard that Adonijah the son of Haggith has become king and David our Lord does not know it?" There's that word "know." It's going to be repeated again. We're not going to read that particular section. "Now therefore, come, let me give you advice that you may save your own life and the life of your son Solomon. Go in at once to King David and say to him, 'Did you not, my lord the king, swear to your servant, saying, Solomon, your son, shall reign after me, and he shall sit on my throne? Why then is Adonijah king? Then, while you are still speaking with the king, I also will come in after you and confirm your words.'" David is ignorant of what's going on around him. He doesn't realize that Adonijah has exalted himself as king. Furthermore, he has not arranged for a successor. So Nathan hatches this plan for Bathsheba to go in to David and then for him to come in also in order to do something about this situation. Because from Nathan's perspective, Solomon is the one who is supposed to take the throne after David. And David has been derelict in his duties. And David himself recognizes that he is supposed to anoint Solomon, but really hasn't mustered the energy to do it. So Nathan tries to inform David and motivate David. So first of all, Bathsheba in verses 15 through 21, she goes into David, informs him of the situation, tries to motivate him. And then in verses 22 through 27, Nathan goes in to confirm the words of Bathsheba in order to motivate David to step into action. So if you are moping around because of personal decline, because of cultural decline, because of easy ecclesiastical decline, maybe what you need is someone to light a fire under you. That's what Nathan is doing. That's what Bathsheba is doing. They're trying to light a fire under David. And maybe actually as we look at this text, as we pore over it today, that's maybe what the Lord is doing. Maybe that's what the Lord is doing in your life. Perhaps this is the Word of God coming from the Spirit of God, coming through the Spirit of God to you. Is the Lord working through this story to light a fire under you in some way? Well, as we pick up the story, finally, David does something. Verse 28. Then David answered, "Call Bathsheba to me." So she came into the king's presence and stood before the king. And the king swore, saying, "As the Lord lives, who has redeemed my soul out of every adversity, as I swore to you by the Lord, the God of Israel, saying, Solomon, your son shall reign after me, and he shall sit on my throne in my place, even so will I do so this day." Then Bathsheba bowed with her face to the ground and paid homage to the king and said, "May my lord King David live forever." So earlier, there was this young woman who was called to be with David. And now what does David do? He calls for Bathsheba. Now, it should not be lost on us that in the whole scope of the narrative, the last time that David called for Bathsheba, Bathsheba was that very beautiful young woman. That's how she was described in 2 Samuel chapter 11. What happened back then? Well, David was supposed to go out to war with his troops, but instead he stayed back, walked around on his roof, ogled this very beautiful young woman, called for her, called for Bathsheba, and violated her. Now, once again, David calls for Bathsheba, not for the very beautiful young woman, and Bathsheba, of course, is not a beautiful young woman anymore, but nevertheless, David calls for her to do what? To do what he is supposed to do as king. He is supposed to anoint a successor. He has failed up to this point. Now he's going to do something about it. David snaps out of it. What is it that snaps him out of it? It is concern for the next generation. This beautiful young woman couldn't snap him out of it. But when David thinks and is informed about the next generation, what's going on with them, when he thinks about the future of Israel, and he knows that the future of Israel is tied up with the future of humanity, looking down the ages, he decides that he needs to step up. He finds the motivation to step up for the sake of the next generation and the generation after that and all generations. He says to Bathsheba, "I'm going to do something this day, this very day." He arranges for Solomon to be enthroned. And then in verses 32 through 40, that's exactly what he does. He enthrones Solomon. So if you're moping around because of personal decline, because of cultural decline, because of ecclesiastical decline, what is it that can snap you out of it? Perhaps it's concern for the next generation. Not the kind of concern that complains about the next generation and everything that they are doing, but the kind of concern that loves the next generation, the kind of concern that loves the gospel and knows that the future of the gospel is tied up with the next generation, the kind of concern that invests in the next generation, invest in the next generation. That's one of the reasons we have these Summer Leadership Institute college students here all summer long. We want to invest in them. They represent the next generation. This is their summer job, by the way. We are paying them. And what are they doing as young people? They are investing in younger people, children, junior high schoolers, and so forth. That's also one of the reasons to invest in the next generation that we do Vacation Bible School each year, which just completed last week. And we had so many people in this church volunteering. It was amazing to see the number of volunteers this week crawling around all over the place, helping to build into these precious young people for the sake of the gospel, for the sake of the next generation. And by the way, you don't have to be old to invest in the next generation. You just have to be older. Older than people that you are investing in. For example, in this church, we have people as young as 12 who are volunteering in our children's ministry. We had junior hires crawling all over the place during VBS this week. It was an amazing thing to behold. David called for Bathsheba. Maybe you should call for Alice Ann, children's ministry. Call for Rolana Smith, junior high ministry. Call for Paco Lopez, high school ministry. Call for Liz Coolidge, college ministry. Call for Dan Westman, young adults ministry. There's all sorts of ways to get involved in the younger generation at this church, if at the very least simply by praying for the next generation. My wife, Karen Grant, has taken it upon herself to start and to lead a ministry that she calls We Care. And this is for students who have come up at PBC, graduated from the PBC high school ministry, and gone off to college or gone off to wherever they are. And we know statistics are not promising in this regard. That if you look at the whole statistics of people growing up in the church, most people who grow up in the church after high school leave the church, or at least after college. Far and away, most of those people who grow up in the church leave the church. They leave Christ. Is there anything that we can do about that? And so one of the things that Karen does with this particular group of people, and you can join this if you want, is once a month they get prayer requests from these people by Facebook from all over the country. How can we pray for you? And once a month during the second service, by the way, they gather together and they pray for the students who have grown up here at Peninsula Bible Church. And the other thing that they do is at least once a year they send those students care packages to let them know that this church has not forgotten about them, that this church loves them. David did something this day when he heard about it. Perhaps you should do something this day, if only to find some young person that you know about that you can pray for. Is there somebody you know that you can pray for? Maybe you could also have a relationship with that person, but at the very least, you can pray for that young person. We, of course, are a multi-generational church. We are not targeting a particular demographic. We're not a boomer church. We're not a hipster church. We're not a Gen X church. We're not a millennial church. We're just a church. And God has brought all ages to be with us. You know, any given week, you see someone who's departing from us to be with the Lord. You see somebody joining us. It's really a great thing. God has done this among us. And by the way, I talk to lots of college students who are here, and one of the reasons they are here is because they don't want to go to some targeted church. They have that in their whole experience at the universities around here. And what they want to do is they want to come to a church on a Sunday morning and worship with all the generations. And so we're blessing them in that way. If there was anyone who had a right to withdraw in the face of cultural and ecclesiastical decline, it was Dietrich Bonhoeffer. He faced the fury of the Third Reich. The Nazis took over Germany. The Nazis also took over the church. And Bonhoeffer could have withdrawn. In fact, he was overseas at the time, and he recognized that he had to go back. He had to go back to Germany to fight for the soul of the church. And he wrote a letter to some of his closest friends called the Christmas Letter, and he says this to them. The ultimate question for a responsible man to ask is not how he is to extricate himself heroically from the affair, but how the coming generation shall continue to live. How shall the coming generation continue to live? The ultimate question for a responsible church to ask is how can the coming generation be enabled to live? And in this country, we have aging baby boomers who are trying to hold on to the last vestiges of their long-faded youth and somehow trying to recreate the past or somehow trying to hold on to it. They're thinking about themselves. How do I become young again? Mark Freeman of Encore.org says this to those people: maybe we can stop trying to stay young and instead rally to help people who actually are. It's a challenge, isn't it? Kara Powell, who is of the Fuller Youth Institute, who has spoken at this church, says this: I can think of no better way to change a country, any country, than through a reinvigorated church. I can think of no better way to change a church than infusing it with passionate young people. I can think of no better way to develop passionate young people than to help them understand that God's grace, love, and mission answer their deepest heart cries. And who is going to help them understand? Well, as we move along in our story from verses 41 to 53, we find that the supporters of Adonijah abandon him. They fear reprisals because from Solomon, and so they abandon him. And the only recourse then for Adonijah is to beg for mercy from Solomon, and that's what he does, and Solomon grants him mercy, at least for the time being. So notice, David steps up, Adonijah steps back. If we step up to be a positive influence for the sake of the next generation, perhaps some of the negative influences in their lives will step back. So David has stepped up to enthrone Solomon. Now he steps up to commission Solomon. 1 Kings chapter 2, verse 1. When David's time to die drew near, he commanded Solomon his son, saying, "I am about to go the way of all the earth. Be strong and show yourself a man, and keep the charge of the Lord your God, walking in all his ways and keeping his statutes, his commandments, his rules, and his testimonies, as it is written in the law of Moses, that you may prosper in all that you do and wherever you turn. That the Lord may establish his word that he spoke concerning me, saying, if your sons pay close attention to their way, to walk before me in faithfulness with all their heart and with all their soul, you shall not lack a man on the throne of Israel." Essentially, David says this to Solomon: follow the Lord. He commissions him, and he commissions him with words reminiscent of Moses' words to Joshua: follow the Lord. And he also looks forward, talking about a man, you know, being on the throne, looking forward through the generations and the generations and the generations, finally culminating, of course, in the Son of David, who sits on the throne of David even now and reigns over all creation. How are we to encourage the next generation? One of the ways to do so is by telling your story, or telling a chapter of your story. Because young people want to know, if they're actually trying to follow Jesus, they want to know, does this thing work? Maybe it works now, but 5 years from now, 10 years from now, 20 years, 50 years from now, does it still work? And those of us who have followed Jesus through the decades can tell them absolutely it works. We can tell them the stories of God's faithfulness in our own lives. So David commissions Solomon, but he also has specific instructions concerning specific individuals. Verse 5. "Moreover, you also know what Joab, the son of Zeruiah, did to me, how he dealt with the two commanders of the armies of Israel, Abner, the son of Ner, and Amasa, the son of Jether, whom he killed, avenging in time of peace for blood that had been shed in war, and putting the blood of war on the belt around his waist and on the sandals on his feet. Act, therefore, according to your wisdom, but do not let his gray head go down to Sheol in peace. But deal loyally with the sons of Barzillai, the Gileadite, and let them be among those who eat at your table, for with such loyalty they met me when I fled from Absalom, your brother. And there is also with you Shimei, the son of Gera, the Benjamite from Bahurim, who cursed me with a grievous curse on the day when I went to Mahanaim. But when he came down to meet me at the Jordan, I swore to him by the Lord, saying, I will not put you to death with the sword. Now, therefore, do not hold him guiltless, for you are a wise man. You will know what you ought to do to him, and you shall bring his gray head down with blood to Sheol. Then David slept with his fathers and was buried in the city of David. And the time that David reigned over Israel was 40 years. He reigned 7 years in Hebron and 33 years in Jerusalem. So Solomon sat on the throne of David his father, and his kingdom was firmly established." David rose up to make sure that the kingdom of Solomon was firmly established. Now, what is David doing at the end? Is he simply settling scores, arranging for the execution of two individuals? Is that what he's doing? I would submit to you that what David actually has in mind is the unity in the kingdom of God, because Joab and Shimei have proved themselves to be partisans through and through. Joab, a partisan of the south, Shimei, a partisan in the north. And yet Barzillai has been faithful neither to north nor south, but to David. And so David says, bless Barzillai and his sons. So at the beginning of our story, David couldn't even get warm. He was in bed. He couldn't even get out of bed. Now something has lit a fire under David. He enthrones Solomon, he commissions Solomon, and he instructs Solomon. David had more left in the tank after all. What do you have left in the tank? Listen to the psalmist, Psalm 71, verse 18. So even to old age and gray hairs, O God, do not forsake me until I proclaim your might to another generation, your power to all those to come. This hardly needs comment. Let me simply read it again. So even to old age and gray hairs, O God, do not forsake me until I proclaim your might to another generation, your power to all those to come. So when I was scheduled to teach at this retreat for Santa Clara University, and I woke up on a Friday morning depressed, I drove over to Santa Clara to take some of the students with me down to Monterey where the retreat was going to be held. And a funny thing happened. As soon as I showed up to pick up those students, and about four or five guys piled into my minivan, I wasn't depressed anymore. I snapped out of it. And we started talking and driving down to Monterey, and I had a great time with the guys. And once I got there, I was still a little concerned about connecting with the students in the in-between times. But I put myself forward, and the Lord created these connections between us. And so I was not lacking for opportunities to encourage these students in the in-between times also. And I announced to them at the beginning of the retreat on Friday night, I said, okay, I've identified a cafe. It's about four blocks from here, and there's this beautiful spot. It's right on the ocean. There's this plaza that overlooks the ocean, and I'm going to be down there every morning at 7 a.m., and I will talk to you about anything that you want to talk about, personal issues, theological issues, questions that you have. I'll talk to you about anything. The only rule in all of this, aside from that, is this. You are not allowed to pay for your drink. I'm going to pay for all of your coffee drinks or whatever you want. I'm going to pay for that on Saturday and Sunday morning, and I'll be down there at 7 a.m. Now, I didn't know if I'd get any customers, because 7 a.m. is awfully early for college students who don't even start to play Murder Mafia until midnight on Friday and Saturday nights and don't even finish until 3 a.m. I spent $40 on coffee drinks. I had four or five customers each morning. And it was great as we hung out on the plaza and the sun was rising and the waves were crashing at our feet and we were talking to all manner of stuff as it concerns relationship with Christ and theological issues. And so my time with those college students, they dispelled my depression. I wasn't depressed anymore. In fact, I was totally invigorated by being with them. I left that retreat walking on air and encouraged to continue moving forward and investing in the lives of people, all people, also, of course, young people. At the end of the retreat, one of the students came up to me and he said, "You have way more life experience than I do." Well, I should hope so. But did he have to use the word way? And did he have to emphasize that word? You have way more life experience than I do. I hang out with college students, but I also teach this Bible study for seniors on Wednesdays over here in the D building, which is great. It is fabulous. This is a very loving community. They love the Word of God. They love to pray. It's great to be with these people. I love being with the college students. I love being with the seniors also. And one of the things I do at the seniors' Bible study is we study the text that I'm going to preach here on Sunday. And by the way, I don't know what qualifies you as a senior around here, but you're invited, I think, if you're somewhat like a senior. I don't know what that is, but please come. So I was telling them about my experience at the Santa Clara University retreat, and I told them all about being with them and how I was depressed, and I shared with them this text, and this text really encouraged me, and then I got to the retreat, and that encouraged me, and I told them about the $40 I spent on college students and drinks. And one of those drinks, by the way, is one guy ordered a pumpkin spice latte grande with whipped cream all over it, and you look at the thing, this is monstrous. You think, is there coffee in there someplace? But anyway, so it was a great investment. It was the best $40 I ever spent. And I told the seniors about that story. Next week, I come to the seniors' Bible study, lead the Bible study. After the study, one of the couples comes up to me, hands me an envelope. Inside the envelope was a note of appreciation, expressing thanks to me for investing in the next generation, for teaching the college students at this particular retreat. Also inside the envelope, two $20 bills. Reimbursement for the money that I spent on coffee for the next generation.